Broadcasting from Baltimore, Maryland, and all around the world, you're listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. Tune in each Thursday on iTunes for the latest episodes of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Sign up for the free show archive at investorhour.com. Here is your host, Dan Ferris.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm also the editor of Extreme Value, a value investing service published by Stansberry Research. We have a really cool show today. I'll interview David Levine, a very impressive investor whose ideas I think every investor ought to consider right now. Then I'll dig into the mailbag and we'll talk about what's on listeners' minds. But first, I want to talk to you about something else. We're changing the format of the show starting today. Since earlier this year, we've brought you four segments each week: my opening monologue, a look at what's new in the world, a guest interview, and our fun and popular mailbag segment. The listener feedback has been good, but I have to tell you, in my heart of hearts, I just don't think it's possible to do four things really well every week. If you like the show the way it is, I promise you, it's not really going to change that much. We're just going to try to make it better by delivering nearly identical content in a different way. So instead of doing all four segments each week, from now on, we'll break them up. One week, we'll do an interview and a mailbag segment. Then the next week, we'll do a segment designed to help you become a better investor, plus the mailbag. So this week, for example, we'll do an interview with our guest, David Levine. Can't wait for you to hear what he has to say. Then next week, we won't do an interview, but I will tell you what's on my mind, including some of what's in the news, with the goal of helping you, our listener, become a better investor. So we'll continue to finish the show with the mailbag each week, as usual, but in an effort to improve the quality of the show and give you an even better version of the segments you like the most, we'll focus our efforts each week instead of trying to do so many things at once. If you like or don't like the new format, let us know. Write in to feedback@investorhour.com and let us know if you still like the show as much as before or if you like it even better. Okay, now let's talk with David Levine. This week's guest is David Levine. David is the founder of Odin River and operates the popular Paranoid Bull Twitter account. He has spent his career at top private equity and hedge fund institutions. David is an advisor and investor in numerous startups, including Artivest, a successful fintech company with over 100 employees and $3 billion in assets under management, which he helped to found. David was previously a key member of the investment teams at Paulson & Company and Colony Capital. Can't wait to talk about that. David graduated from Washington University in St. Louis with an AB in philosophy and a BSBA in finance. David earned both an MBA from Harvard Business School and JD from Harvard Law School and is a member of the New York Bar. David lives in Greenwich, Connecticut, with his entrepreneur wife and two young children. David Levine, welcome to the program, sir. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Really excited about the conversation.
Okay, so David, when I see somebody who has put together, let's face it, a pretty impressive resume here, it makes me wonder, how old were you when you first had an inkling that, yep, finance careers for me, that's where I'm headed? How old were you?
Well, you know, I when I was in college, I was pretty focused on philosophy, and I played football, and so I'm like, you know, kind of reading Nietzsche and playing linebacker, and you know, my dad, as dads are, gave good practical advice. He's like, you know, you might want to add finance to the philosophy degree, and so I did it. You know, partially just kind of practically speaking, realizing that, you know, I probably wouldn't be a philosopher. Although I guess Twitter is the closest you can get to being a modern day philosopher or something. So I do still like philosophy, but I'd say that kind of by, you know, the third or fourth year of college, so by my junior or senior year, I started to realize that dad had given me very good advice. And actually, you know, my junior year, in the summer, I came up to Wall Street for the first time. This was kind of in the go-go.com days. It's when Nobu first opened up downtown. I was working in tech M&A at Lehman. And man, was it fun. You know, it was deals. It was the bubble. And so, you know, at that point, like I said, I was 20. It became pretty clear that, you know, that maybe I was 21, but I was going to come, you know, up to New York and kind of see what this Wall Street thing was all about. You know, I had at that point been day trading and stuff. You know, I was bad at it. Like I was really bad day trading, you know, in college. And so I had an interest in the markets, but, you know, but I came up to Wall Street primarily to kind of focus on M&A. And this was kind of the bubble a couple bubbles ago. You know, it's funny, by the time I got up here, you know, I came to work at Lehman in 2001. I lived a few blocks away from World Trade on 9/11. And, you know, so between kind of the dot-com bubble collapsing before I got here and then the World Trade Center falling, you know, within a couple months of arrival, within a few blocks from where I live, across the street from where I worked, you know, the veneer of the, you know, I guess the allure of an impenetrable bubble that was a dot-com boom had come off, and I, you know, experienced a, you know, real trauma with the World Trade Center falling. But I've been in, you know, in markets and in Wall Street and finance in some way ever since. So that's kind of how I got involved. You know, and I've, you know, like I said, been involved, you know, for the last couple of decades now through, you know, the bust of one cycle, the bust of another cycle, and now on the precipice of, you know, the bust of a third bubble. So, you know, I think with that experience, it's kind of given me some perspective about things, but I'm still learning, you know, I'm still early in this thing, only a couple of decades in.
So tell me about, I want to hear a little bit, at least, about Colony Capital and Paulson and Company. Which one was first?
So I started out, you know, after banking. So I kind of worked in M&A. I got very lucky, you know, I was working tech M&A and that kind of, you know, the deal flow like ended. So I was very quickly kind of shifted over to do power and energy M&A. So I worked on deals pretty much the whole time in banking. I actually had a great experience in investment banking, learned a ton and, you know, kind of relatively quickly learned about the quote unquote buy side and that private equity was a good place to be. I kind of got recruited over to that side of things. And so ended up, you know, very luckily kind of landing at Colony Capital. This is before I went to grad school. At the time, you know, there's a few billion in AUM. You know, Tom Barrack, the founder, you know, was very hands-on. Again, I got pretty lucky with the experience, you know, working on, you know, we created the largest private gaming company. We bought a baseball stadium in Japan. You know, I was flying all around the world, you know, really investing in private companies. And that was just an incredible experience learning, you know, kind of how to see things from an investor's perspective and, you know, deploying, you know, significant sums of capital, on a small team. But I had kind of also at that point, become exposed to, you know, the way that these financial bubbles work. And, you know, it really hit me. I remember we were bidding on this kind of large portfolio of office buildings. And I remember it being like a few hundred, you know, close to $1 billion. And before I'd even really done the analysis, I was kind of leading the analysis on the deal. We had these banks clamoring to lend us money, you know, at 80% of LTV and, you know, LIBOR plus 150. And they were just fighting and fighting to give us capital. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, where's all this money coming from? And so that's actually part of the reason why I went back to school. And part of the reason why I created the blog Paranoid Bull, which I created it in 2007 while I was doing my JD and my MBA at Harvard. But I went back after this experience at Colony, which was great. But I went back with this idea, you know, that we were in a bubble and that there was going to be some collapse on the other side. You know, so I focused while I was at school on distress. You know, I was like the kid in the bankruptcy law class who loved it. And because of that, you know, my bankruptcy professor, who's now, you know, a leading presidential candidate, Elizabeth Warren, like I was the one who would like go up after class, talk to her. I ended up being her TA and research assistant. I was super interested in distress because I thought we'd be entering a credit cycle kind of on the other side of the bubble that we were in. You know, it was a little early. Like I got pretty worried about it, 05, 06. But by 07, I was so worried about it, I started blogging about it constantly. And so, you know, I spent my time in school at the law school and the business school really focused on moving from private equity over to hedge funds. And so, you know, I kind of got very lucky. I worked at a large fund of funds that introduced me to some some really great hedge funds, including Canyon Capital. I spent some time there. And then I met John Paulson while I was in school. Again, really lucky in terms of the timing of it. You know, I was like the only guy who my friends were graduating from business school talking about mortgages. It's like 07. I'm like, guys, trust me, this is a really big deal. And they're like, dude, come on, drink a beer. Stop being so negative. But John, of course, had it all figured out. So, you know, when I met him, really resonated. You know, and by the time I was graduating from doing the JD and MBA from Harvard, you know, he invited me to join his investment team, which at the time had, you know, close to 20 people. And I think at peak, we had about $40 billion in capital. So it was a pretty great experience, you know, and at that point, you know, the cycle had turned. And so, you know, it kind of was a great way to transition from the private equity side of things to the hedge fund side of things and to do it, you know, with a great scale of capital, learning from one of the best investors, in my opinion, ever. And so, you know, it was a great experience working at Paulson & Company, you know, and, you know, it was great to kind of like both see the collapse and then see the recovery. You know, in the Paranoid Bull, the name of this, the Twitter account, the blog that I started, you know, I've always been optimistic. You know, it was never that I didn't kind of believe in progress. Actually, now Odin Rivers is the opposite. It's about progress is inevitable, but cycles matter. So I wasn't surprised when, you know, we had the recovery, you know, after 09, it just, you know, we needed to clear things out in 08. And so sitting in that seat, you know, kind of at Paulson, you know, for those period of years, kind of through the collapse and out of it, was a great way to kind of see, you know, the crash to kind of, you know, invest at, you know, one of the largest hedge funds at the time and also and see the recovery. And it also gives perspective now because like thinking back to those days, I just saw this headline yesterday, it was some deal that was announced and it said, the transaction multiple was relatively attractive. It was only 28 times EBITDA. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, only 28 times EBITDA. I mean, whoa. We were buying companies at 4 times EBITDA, you know, in 09. So anyways, that's a little bit of background on those experiences, but glad to talk about them more or, you know, anything else.
I'm just curious, when exactly did you start with Paulson?
So I met...
You said it was after the turn?
Yeah, I was there kind of in I guess June or July of 2009, and you know, I met John the first time 2007 while I was in school, and so I got kind of the job offer to join him while I was in my final year of school. I guess it was like September of 08, you know, sometime right around the time of the crash. So I was, you know, it was just one of these things where I happened to be doing school and like I was, you know, doing research for Elizabeth Warren on bankruptcy stuff and, you know, had worked at this other hedge fund called Canyon that was a really great firm. It's on the West Coast. Very good firm that still exists today. You know, but the timing really worked out well in that, you know, I kind of met John and then, you know, as the world was falling apart, like he was kind of building his team. And so, you know, when I left, I joined him in the kind of summer of 09 and I was there for about 4 years.
Wow. Very cool. And okay. So then let's just talk a little bit about Odin, what you're doing right now.
Yeah. So the, it's, you know, it's the main idea of it. It's really a philosophy that, you know, it's about progress is inevitable. And so I'm actually massively optimistic. I call it a mission driven investment firm. You know, and I kind of believe very deeply that in the long run, every single industry will be modernized and will be transparent. And as a result, you know, I think the only kinds of businesses that will exist in the long run will be mission-driven and have a values-based culture. So I'm massively optimistic, and it's kind of why I've spent time, you know, investing in and building early-stage companies that are mission-driven, because that's kind of in 10 years, those are the companies that will be at scale. However, you know, I wish sometimes like, oh, wouldn't it be great if cycles didn't matter, but they do. And so, you know, the mantra of Odin River is progress is inevitable, but cycles matter. And so what it is, it's right now I'm managing a net short, you know, investment strategy. We've been doing that the last few years. But I also, because I believe very deeply in transparency, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of sharing the ideas and specifically this notion that cycles matter, you know, through Paranoid Bull. And the reason is that I think it's really important that we, you know, kind of have an open have open eyes and also kind of collaborate with one another to be aware of what's coming, which I think is actually quite bad. You know, my motivation for starting the blog last cycle was similar to the motivation for, you know, focusing on the Twitter account now, meaning that, you know, it's just, there's a lot of bad stuff out there. I think it's important that people are aware of it. So, you know, I kind of, you know, spend time managing some money, but then I also spend time, you know, like, you know, I'm sure is how we got to know each other is spending time just in these public forums, sharing the ideas. Cause you know, in my opinion, in the very long run, the world's going to be transparent. So we might as well embrace that. That's why I've been tweeting every day since 2007. I've sent, you know, 80,000 tweets, which is an average of like more than 15 a day since July 2007. So I've kind of been leaning into this transparency thing. And, you know, so cycles matter. You know, the reason I'm net short and the reason, you know, that I'm kind of spending so much time on Twitter with the paranoid bull handle is that I'm really quite concerned about where we are cyclically, you know, in the same way that, you know, the dot-com bubble burst and then the housing bubble burst. I think we're kind of in the midst of, you know, I would say an even worse, you know, systemic type cycle right now. And so I'm quite concerned about it. And that's why I spend a lot of time, you know, in addition to kind of being net short in my own investment strategy, to kind of talk about it in the public way that I do.
So, David, before we get into the cycles matter half of this, I want to spend a little bit more time on the, you know, I'm a super optimistic guy thing. Tell me exactly what you mean by mission-driven companies.
So what I believe is that, so you know how like when there was this document, it was written, it said, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. You know, there's these kind of like really deep truths that I think are permanent. And those truths, one of them is, you know, that in the long run, what happens is that technology will crush the cost of information forever. And the reason is that's what technology does. It makes information more accessible. And what happens in that type of world is that the world becomes more transparent. What I mean by that is certain themes like increased transparency, miniaturization, things that we can see like AI and cloud computing, these themes are permanent. And what happens when you have these sorts of themes happening, you know, there's firms like Andreessen Horowitz, they say software is eating the world. What I say is that progress is inevitable, meaning that these themes actually make the world a better place. If people have more access to information and the world is more transparent, then people have more education. But it also means that, for instance, a thing that's actually quite good, although dangerous, is passive investing in the reduction and like overcharging kind of long-only value-destructive management. Transparency reduces the cost of information. Therefore, it makes things like passive investing, ETFs, and others more accessible. It also makes things like hedge funds and private equity, venture capital, more accessible, which is why I helped found and build Artivest. It's about creating access to that. Mm-hmm. I'm also so optimistic. I think that we will modernize our infrastructure. I think that we will come up with solutions. The private sector will come up with solutions to things like climate change and, you know, and carbon emissions and things like that. And the reason is, again, because progress is inevitable, because these technological themes are going to occur forever. Now, a lot of people stop there and they become venture capitalists and they're like, okay, well, these things are very great. Let's invest in the future. And I believe in that. And I do, you know, have founded, built, and invested in early stage companies. But the problem is twofold. The first is, even though progress is inevitable, cycles matter, right? We're in the midst of the distressed unicorn cycle right now. WeWork just blew up. It's a distressed unicorn. And there's going to be many, many more of those. Cycles matter means that the prices of everything, even early stage companies, are impacted by the cycle. And if you don't pay any attention to that, you know, then you'll get blown up from time to time. It's just the nature of things. But the other reason is that even though the future is very optimistic, if the future is going to be great, the future is very far from now. And 99.9% of the world is not early stage. 99.9% of assets are not early stage. And for me to be an investor, to care for my own wealth, to care for family's wealth, to care for others' wealth, I have to care about that other 99.9%. Otherwise, I can't truly care for wealth. I can't truly manage my own money, my family's money, or anyone else's money well. And so even though I'm optimistic in the very long run, these themes take a very long time. And in the meanwhile, what's going to happen is that the old system has to be disrupted. The old system, unfortunately, is in the midst of collapsing. And because of that, the optimism actually brings me back to the cyclical nature of things. It brings me back to disruption. Now, I'm very optimistic because I think that creative destruction is great. I think that failure is actually really good. When these old companies get wiped out, new companies will emerge, right? And so I'm very optimistic that, you know, these themes that I mentioned, that companies that are building consistent with these themes, that, you know, that they're going to be the ones that win in the long run. Another very simple point is that, like, if you aren't a mission-driven company today and you don't have a clear focus on values, the millennials will quit your company. Generation Z will never join. And so the young generation is kind of voting with their feet. Every startup you speak to nowadays understands this. Older companies are kind of getting it, but for most of them, it's too late. You know, they were built in a legacy time, so they have to go away, and that's fine. That's part of the cyclical nature of things. I think failure is good. I think failure is healthy. I think recessions aren't necessarily so bad as long as, you know, they're not devastating and we can come back from them, which I think we have always, and I think we will. So, I mean, that's kind of how these two sides of the coin fit together. You know, the optimism ties into the cyclical nature of things, and it just so happens, you know, we're at the end of the largest expansion in history and probably the biggest bubble in history. And so it just so happens that right now is quite a pessimistic time given where we are, right? So in 2013, if we had been talking, I would have been, you know, I was levered, you know, long. I was very long. I was long early stage companies. I was not shorting much of anything because it didn't make sense at that time in the expansion, right? So it's like, I think you have to kind of be aware of where we are. And it just so happens that where we are, cycles matter. That's the main thing right now. And we see it everywhere. I mean, it's like we can't go a day without seeing 100 things that are a reminder of where we are.
So I understand the idea that technology improves the quality of life, that these things are inevitable. But there's a lot of pushback today on things like social media and the and how it affects one's quality of life, how having all these screens sort of begging for our attention all the time affects, and many people conclude, kind of degrades our quality of life. How do you feel about that? I mean, you're an optimistic guy.
Yeah, but that's kind of like saying like that the Model T was like a really shitty car. And like, of course it was, right? It's like we are so early, right? Like Twitter was the first social network, basically. Like Friendster was horrible. Twitter was a little, you know, maybe Facebook kind of was a social network, but at first it was just like a picture of your friends at Harvard or something, you know? And so like it's morphed into like a really decent kind of like website to look at pictures and tell people happy birthday and advertisers to target people. But like, you know, I think that Twitter is probably the closest approximation of what we've ever seen to what a social network is or should be, but it's the first one, you know? So it's like, it's very early in the development of these future technologies. And what happens, unfortunately, first of all, there's a legacy set of advertising business models that itself is kind of gross and creates really bad behavior. So it creates the behavior that if I can trigger you to click on this thing, then I'm going to get paid by the advertiser because there's engagement. Now, that whole idea of the old media that's dying, trying to trigger us with breaking everything, is just a sign of the old media dying, right? It's a sign of the transition from an old system to a new system, meaning you remember like 10 years ago, you turn on CNN and it would like every now and then at the bottom of the screen, it'd say breaking news. But now you can't turn on a screen anywhere without them clamoring for your attention. So in my opinion, that's just a product of the disruption that we're experiencing, meaning these old businesses are failing. Their old business models don't work. They're trying to interface with the social media stuff and trigger us as much as they can to get us to click. But I think that's just a natural part of the transition to, in my opinion, what will be a better future. When we'll have better social networks, I think better social networks will be founded and created, and they won't be based on advertising, right? This whole idea of what decentralization promises, which is the crypto world, it's about the users owning the network. Why wouldn't the users own the future Twitter? I think they should. We probably should own Twitter today. That's fine. That'll happen. It'll come. And so just like the Model T, you know, was kind of a shitty car, and if we had kind of like stopped at that, we'd be pretty disappointed. Like now we have like these incredible, you know, sports cars and electric vehicles and, you know, hey, maybe someday flying cars, I don't know. But like things evolve, right? So social media will evolve too. And old media will die and then there'll be, you know, new forms of media. And that's disruptive, sure, of course. And that feeds into the political moment that we're in, right? And when you're in a political moment where populism is exploding and you have these like old media channels that are losing their power, you have the struggles that are going on, of course it's going to be disruptive. And the fact that we feel it more palpably because the world's more transparent, I don't know, maybe that's a good thing, right? Maybe it's good that we're engaged with how bad things are. You know, I don't know that it's necessarily bad that we feel bad because the situation's actually very bad. So I don't know. I of course, you know, we need to be thoughtful about how we use tech. We need to be thoughtful, especially about how our kids use tech. We need to be thoughtful about screen time. You know, not everything's a panacea, like, you know, but it's just so early. I think it would be crazy to kind of say this is the, that because Facebook did a great job of like monopolizing like all the, universities, like databases and websites and photo albums that now like social media is ruined forever. I think it's absurd. You know, I think it's just one really good company that's done well and there'll be others, but I'm an optimist.
Right. That's right. And your money is where your mouth is on this, right? You're long Twitter, correct?
Yeah, that's true. I'm long Twitter. It's one of my biggest long positions. I remain long today, you know, even when it was hated and done, whatever, the teens or whatever. I am long it. I think that, you know, I think that it's got quite a bit of promise. It's probably the most important company. It's definitely the most important media company on the planet, and maybe it's one of the most important companies because it is our conduit to the world's information. There's no way out of it at this point. I mean, President Trump has clinched that, right? He knew he could reach the people. He did it, and now it's become the only mechanism, truly, to directly communicate with the people. And so, yeah, it's so strategically important. I think it's cheap.
Interesting. Okay, but overall, still net short. And we were talking earlier, and frankly, from reading your Twitter feed, you are. I understand the combination of optimism and the meaning behind being a paranoid bull, but your voice is so consistent on Twitter. The unwind is here. It's happening. It will continue. I mean, it is, one would say, consistently bearish right now. When you say cycles matter, you mean you're way bearish on, I assume, stocks and probably bonds, I would guess, too, at this point. No?
So cycles matter. So the reason, yeah. So here's the other thing. The pinned tweet that I have on my Twitter profile says, these things take time, patience, kids. And the reason is that, I mean, it's so hard to fathom how badly they broke things. It's like the ability to conceptualize $1 trillion, it's pretty much beyond our ability to understand as a human. The ability to understand many trillions of dollars of direct distortionary asset purchases that were intentionally done to manipulate markets by central banks, it's truly unfathomable. Meaning the scale, so it's kind of like if the best, maybe one analogy is like there's like a gigantic aircraft carrier and it's moving in one direction. That aircraft carrier is the economy. By the way, Bernanke used this a similar kind of metaphor at one point. In one of his congressional testimonies, he was saying landing the economy on an aircraft carrier was his goal, which good luck. But if you start to move an aircraft carrier, let's say you're like throwing a $1 bill at it, it doesn't move. And you start throwing 100, then you start throwing 1,000, then you start throwing 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000, then 1,000,000,000,000. And finally you start throwing like $5 trillion at this aircraft carrier and it starts to turn. You know, you've really done a lot in terms of printing money and kind of intentionally changing the nature of things. And it took, you know, if you think about it, like this is the longest expansion, quote unquote expansion that we've had, you know, going back at least in recent memory. And, you know, it took a few years to get going. Like they were printing and printing and printing and printing and people were still bearish and bearish and bearish. And then eventually like people caught on and they're like, oh, wow, like this bubble of both increased debt, increased leverage, buybacks, passive money, and the search for yield, which was forced upon every pension fund, insurance company, and saver in the world by central banks took time to play out. Now, here we are on the other side of that, where, in my opinion, what happened is central banks intentionally underpriced systemic risk, meaning the risk-free rate should never be zero, ever, both because we know there's some positive background growth and you know, population, therefore inflation, but more importantly, because we know systemic risk is positive, because in 2008 we learned it was positive. Therefore, there needs to be some compensation for the political risk, systemic risk that's embedded in governments and embedded in government debt. The risk-free rate should never be zero, and of course it shouldn't be negative. But what happened is these central bankers had this idea. They're like, okay, what we could do is what we'll do is we'll cut it lower and then even lower. And they're like, oh, the ZLB, zero lower bound, that's just an idea. Like it's not just an idea. The zero lower bound is just a reflection of the fact there's risk in the world and we need to be compensated for risk if we loan each other money. It's like so absolutely basic. But because they're academics, they don't care about the basics of actual finance. They don't care about the basic of actual, you know, lending and borrowing in the banking system. And so what they did is they intentionally underpriced systemic risk and then took many trillions of dollars and bought, you know, many assets and inflated every asset class. And it took a long time. So look, I think that unfortunately what happened is not only did they create the largest credit bubble in history, the largest global equity bubble in history, private equity, venture capital, and the sorts of asset classes we pay attention to, but they also destroyed the political system. And what I mean by that is that because what you do when you buy assets is you make the rich richer, the central banks directly increased wealth inequality around the world. Wealth inequality is at peak. Wealth inequality is at peak because central banks made it at peak on purpose. Their entire goal was to create a wealth effect so that the economy would be stimulated. If you read Greenspan, Bernanke, the theory behind what they were doing, that is the intent of what they were doing. They knew it. The problem is they forgot about the side effects. The side effects are, oh, if you create massive wealth inequality, what might happen? I don't know. How about a global wave of populism starting in Greece and then going to Brexit and then going to Italy and then going to the United States, where Donald Trump wasn't enough? He was the populist that destroyed the Republican Party. And now you have populists that are going to win, in my opinion, the election. And the United States is going to be even more populist. All as a result of the central bank policy. It's a side effect. It's a political risk. So the problem is that like all this stuff I'm talking about right now, people are going to say, okay, yeah, but what about tomorrow's like S&P 500 number? Is it going to go up or down? And I'm like, okay, well, I do not know that. No one knows that. I cannot tell you what tomorrow's stock price is going to be. We live in a world where people think they can tell you what tomorrow's stock price is going to be, which is insane. We live in a very short-term focused world, and we live in a world where people have been compensated for ignoring all risks and being levered long beta off the top of the biggest bubble in history while political risk is exploding. Political risk, in my opinion, is the number one risk of governments because that is what governments are. Central banks, government money, borrowing from governments, the number one risk of that is politics because that is literally all governments are, that's all central banks are, they're political institutions. And what's absolutely insane is this cycle, it's far worse than last cycle where it was so obvious. By 07, you know, I was some kid, I was like blogging about, you know, CDS and I was like, hey, look at market. And there's hundreds of people that were pretty open about the housing bubble. This cycle is so much worse because every single person you talk to will talk to you about impeachment. They will talk to you about war with China. They will talk to you about some of the most extreme political risks that you can imagine. And then they'll completely ignore that we are at the top of the biggest bubble in history in the sovereign credit market, right? We've got $50 to $60 trillion of government debt that's been intentionally manipulated and mispriced for like a decade. You know, like still $13-14 trillion of negatively yielding government debt, right? It's just totally insane in my opinion. So anyways, I think it's like, you know, the central banks broke it. They were very well intended. They had these ideas, like somewhat right. You know, they're like, you know, wealth effect does actually stimulate the economy. That's true. You know, but I think if you have a wealth effect that creates wealth inequality that leads to populism, that ain't so good, right? Because now you're tearing down the government. And if you let it go on as long as they did, then you have things like the CLO market is bigger than it ever is before. The auto loan market's bigger than it ever is before. LBO multiples are higher than they ever have been before, and on and on and on. You know, revenue to, you know, you've seen the charts. The Hussman does a good job with some of these charts. But anyways, the point is that, like, unfortunately, it would be great if risk didn't exist. It'd be great if we could have like MMT unicorn fairy tales and print money forever and like everyone would be happy and, you know, and the markets would just grow forever and no defaults would ever happen. And, you know, there'll be a magic deal with China and the economy will just do a V-shaped recovery. You know, it'd be great if that didn't, you know, if that was possible, but it's not. Everyone knows it's not, right? And the reason is cycles matter. Risk exists. So the reason why I'm kind of so consistently, you know, you call it pessimistic. I wouldn't call it pessimistic. I just say, you know, honest, intellectually honest about the nature of things, which is quite bad. On the paranoid bull account is I think it's actually very bad and it's getting worse by the day. You know, and it's, there's like these obvious things like today, as of right now, we're having this conversation. S&P 500 is flat since January 26th of 2018. Okay. It hasn't gone up at all in like 18 months. That is not bullish. That is actually very bad, right? You had the Fed reverse course, stop QT, move to now basically QE again with the repo market. You've had the Fed ease. You've had the ECB like try to restart. They've hit the limits of what they can do. you've had like every central bank in the world trying to stimulate, and all we can do is stay flat, and that's bullish. While like the PMI is rolling off a cliff, and we're in an earnings recession, and the president might be impeached, and we're at war with China. Like, it's insane. Like, I don't know how anyone's bullish. It doesn't make any sense to me. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. You never know.
Well, one can always be wrong, but you know, I'm glad you covered a lot of ground there, which I'm grateful for. And among the many things you reminded us of was the wonderful aircraft carrier quote, which, you know, it's not just the way I see it. It's not just that these people don't understand that there are other consequences to their actions. It's that they actually believe when they give you something, an aircraft carrier is a very finite little place. It's a complicated endeavor. They think they're relating the complicated nature of the endeavor to us. But what they're really saying is they're dumb enough to believe that they know where the boundaries are. And they're dumb enough to believe that they actually have control over an economy by fiddling around in the bond market. And you've addressed this quite head on. And you have a name for it, right? The myth of the infallible central banks. When I heard you say that, I was like, yep, that's it.
Yeah, it's very deep. And, you know, it's connected with, you know, kind of the fall of religion. You know, it's connected with, you know, the worship of statistics. You know, in our society, like, more people worship statistics than worship God, which I think is quite sad. You know, and so what happened is we've literally deified these central bankers. We've given them godlike powers. I mean, they have unlimited, you know, at least in Europe. Well, in Europe, there's a constitutional court case reviewing the policy. You know, the policies of Draghi, and Weidman's out, you know, kind of questioning his limits. So now he's leaving office. So like maybe Kuroda in Japan has unlimited power, but, you know, almost unlimited power in these individuals. And they're just people. I've met these people. They're smart. And I think they really mean well, you know, but they're literally just like you and I. They're just these individuals who happen to have gone to some school and got a PhD in something. And now they have this truly almost infinite power of like many trillions of dollars. And the problem is that there's these sayings, and the sayings are things like don't fight the Fed, and the BOJ is the widowmaker. Don't fight the ECB. You had the CEO of Goldman Sachs on Twitter recently saying don't fight the Fed, you know, forgetting the fact that his firm would have failed but for a bailout in 2008, and the Fed was, you know, already in the motion of cutting rates, and more if a bailout wouldn't have mattered. So I think that the truth is, there is some truth to don't fight the Fed, right? They're a lot of power. They're trillions of power. The problem is there's a belief in infallibility. There's a belief in infinite power. The truth is there are limits to central bank power. Those limits are political. Political risk is a very explicit limit on central bank power. There are legal limits on central bank power. And ultimately, there are market limits. You know, and the market limits, you know, they take time. They may come in like very, you know, kind of binary ways, you know, kind of black swan or unpredictable, you know, kind of ways. And these different ways of legal kind of politics and tail-like events that will, in my opinion, reveal how, and I think they already have revealed how broken things are. You know, I think in retrospect, well, you know, the central banks will say, oops, maybe we shouldn't have done that. But it's too late, you know, they already did. So here we are. You know, I think that there is a myth of the infallible central bank, infallible central banks that underpins like a lot of modern finance, including passive investing, including things like don't fight the Fed, including, you know, the belief that yield chasing isn't incredibly dangerous, even though it is, you know, the belief that negative rates make any kind of sense at all. I mean, $1 trillion in negative yielding corporate debt as of a month or so ago. I mean, it's just crazy. And all this is based on this false myth. You know, some myths can be true, but the false myth that central banks are infallible, they're not. And so cycles matter.
So when you and I talked before the interview, you talked about the strangely delusional dialogue that people have where you don't think they're nearly bearish enough, and I tend to agree. And I wonder if I could ask you a very specific question as an example of this. Like, you hear, and you've even heard Warren Buffett say, basically, that stocks are cheap these days relative to interest rates. And to me, That sounds practically insane, given what, you know, what you've discussed here and what we all know about interest rates today, right? That they're really suppressed. What do you think people, when people say stocks are cheap relative to interest rates, what do you think of that? Isn't it crazy?
Yeah, to me, it's really simple. So it's just, that's why I boil it down to the mispricing of the risk-free rate and the mispricing of systemic risk. So think about it this way. Like, people are mad because, you know, the presidential candidate on the left who's going to win, Senator Warren, you know, who has a good chance of winning the presidency, when she says that there should be a wealth tax of 1% to 2%. And I was actually kind of worried about it, and I didn't like it at first. But I got to thinking, I was like, wait, what is central bank policy really? What they're doing is they're faking like rates are 1% to 2% below what they should be, meaning they're intentionally manipulating the rates down by 1% or 2%. Now, 1% or 2% may not sound a lot, but 2% on a 10-year duration bond, which most of the negatively yielding bond is close to that level, 2% is a 20% move. So the prices of these things have been inflated by 20, 30, 40%. You had the Australian 50-year was up like 50% in the last 12 months. So the assets have been inflated. And so what happens when you underprice debt, it's kind of like you're giving free money. You're giving like a subsidy. So you're giving like free money to the wealthy. So in a way, there's been this central bank underpricing of risk by a couple percent that has been a subsidy for the wealthy. So that's why the current system, in my opinion, is kind of like socialism for the rich. It's not, it's like not real capitalism. It's like a subsidy for, you know, the current asset holders. So just to answer your question, like very specifically, the problem is that risk-free rate, meaning the interest rate that's embedded in the markets, is artificially low, and it's intentionally been made artificially low. And so the fact that, you know, rates have been suppressed, it causes these distortionary ideas that, you know, we should be kind of assuming that distortionary background interest rates will persist forever, which we know, you know, won't, in my opinion. The other thing is that when you look at things like the market risk premium and you look at things like growth rates, you know, it seems like in a world where we're entering a global recession and we're kind of maybe in it already, and in a world where there's a lot more uncertainty, that, you know, the market risk premium should probably be higher and growth rates should be lower. So even on these lower interest rates, you know, I don't know that stocks are necessarily cheap, meaning like if you take the 2.5%, you add like a 5% market risk premium, you know, and kind of a no growth environment, you know, then multiples should be much lower. It's just, you know, you can kind of not even assuming change in the interest rates, and the math on the market would be the multiples should be lower than they are today, just based on a normal kind of market risk premium. And given the environment, kind of given the risky environment that we have. So, you know, I think that multiples need to come down. Earnings are already, we're in an earnings recession probably in Q3. Margins are at peak. You know, we've got all sorts of reasons why margins are coming down. And so another way to kind of think about stocks in a very, from a very, very simplistic perspective is, you know, if multiples fall 20%, which is quite normal, they should fall more than that. They usually do in a cycle. If they fall 20% and margins fall 20%, stocks would be down 40%. But there's no reason why margins couldn't fall something like 30% and multiples could fall something like 30%. So stocks could easily be down 60 or 70% just based on a normalization of multiples and margins. And, you know, so it's just, it's just how these things go. Like, margins don't stay at peak forever. Multiples don't stay at peak forever. And the reason is that cycles matter. The reason is risk exists. And, you know, that's, it's starting to materialize in a bunch of ways, and I think it will continue to.
Okay, I've got one more thing on this thread, and then we'll wrap up with a final question. So my one thing about wealth tax is this. I think, by the way, you describe your reasoning makes perfect sense to me. The one thing I would add, though, is that isn't there a difference between, you know, say two guys are worth $100 million and one of them made his $100 million building a business and manufacturing some kind of a widget and doing a great job of it. And then the other one made his money because he worked on Wall Street selling, you know, CDO squared and CLOs and a bunch of stuff. I mean, I feel like one guy is the salt of the earth who has made this world, you know, the wonderful place that it is, and the other guy is a crook. So I would hope that such a tax would distinguish between these two, but I don't know if it will.
I agree very much with the sentiment that you have. I think it's, if I were to kind of say the reason why I was really, I'm still not totally like on, you know, fully in a full throated way endorsing it. I just understand why I think it's fair. To me, the key things to get right are exactly what you're talking about, like taxing private business owners, you know, reducing the incentive for innovation, entrepreneurship, business building, especially with small and medium sized businesses, forcing like illiquid, you know, private, you know, holdings to kind of pay taxes when there's no liquidity. Like there are various nuances that are related to what you're talking about, which I agree with, which is the spirit of America's entrepreneurship and business building and business owners. And we don't want to do anything to discourage that. So getting that right is crucial. And if any tax proposal doesn't get that right, in my opinion, I think it's a wrong proposal. So I'm hopeful these sorts of things will be kind of correctly built into any sort of, you know, regulation like this or legislation like this. And if it's not, I think it would be quite bad. So I'm with you. I completely agree. You know, and I think it's important to get the nuances right, especially in a, you know, in a world where we need more entrepreneurship. And if the economy does crash, we're going to need even more of it. We want to incentivize it. So I'm with you.
Glad to hear that, because I feel like you and I, we come down on the same place on a lot of these things. Like I too consider myself very optimistic and very much a believer in free market capitalism. And I'm very bearish for many of the same reasons. But if I could ask you, we're just about out of time, but I wonder if I could ask you, like, if there was one last thought that you could leave our listeners with, what might that be? I think I know, but what might it be?
You know, I'm going to say this in a way that may sound scary, because it is. So there is nowhere to hide. But I think people want to, you know, clamor for safety in these sorts of situations. I think, you know, for me, I'm net short. I think that, you know, I was asked for a trade idea on this media channel called Real Vision recently. And I said, you know, the best, probably safest thing is FDIC insured US dollar accounts, although you're taking fiat risk in that. You know, the depth of how broken things are, we see it on our screen, TV screen every day, and the political risk, you know, all around us, is pretty evident. So, you know, I think people need to trust their common sense and probably like stop paying attention to CNBC and others who are kind of telling you that everything's okay, even though you realize it's not. Yeah, I would say that caution and conservatism is perfectly fine. And seeking shelter in an environment that's as turbulent as this one is perfectly reasonable. You know, so that's the one thing I would say, you know, is just that, you know, don't believe any easy answers. If someone tells you there's some magic solution to this, run, because there's not. You know, this is actually quite deeply devastating. We're kind of, you know, in the midst of a political collapse, you know, and which leads into a financial collapse, you know, which could lead to market performance worse in 2008. You know, hopefully the economy won't be as bad. You know, I think it's you know, the bright side of it might be that the markets are probably as bad or worse, but maybe the economy can, you know, avoid some of the like extremely deep outcomes. That's possible. And I hope we can avoid war. That would be really good. Unfortunately, there's many interests that, you know, seem to be incentivized to want war, which I pray we can avoid. But yeah, that's all I would say. You know, I know that's maybe not a downer kind of way to end. I just think it's a very serious time. And so, you know, don't fall for any kind of, you know, any of your listeners. I would just say, don't fall for any, you know, anyone promising you some easy solution, because there's unfortunately not an easy answer.
Sobering words, but I believe wise and appropriate and very timely. And I just want to thank you again for being here, David. And I can tell you, you are definitely getting invited back in the future. So I hope you'll be able to come back and talk with us.
Oh, this is great. I really enjoy the conversation. Thank you so much for the time. And, you know, hope that you enjoy the rest of your week. And, yeah, thanks again for having me.
All right, David. Thanks a lot. We'll hopefully talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Wow. That guy is very smart. And I think he's very disciplined a thinker, and I think he strikes the right tone, being optimistic and yet refusing to hide your head in the sand and refusing to acknowledge that cycles matter is, I think he's spot on, in fact. That's why I wanted to have him on at this time, because his message, I think, is really the right one. Now, I think FDIC insured bank accounts are certainly not a bad thing. I think there's a few other things to do. You know, I think gold will continue to hold up well, and silver, right, by association. But wow, I hope you're as blown away by David Levine as I just was. And I hope you'll kind of think about what he's saying and think about what it means for assets you hold, and even your the next 5 or 10, you know, look into the future and be as optimistic about the future as David, and be as pessimistic about stocks and bonds as David right now. It's not a bad hat to sort of put on and just kind of try to think that way and see how it might help you. So let us move on right now and take a look at the mailbag. So let's take a look and see what's in here this week. Remember, this is where you and I get to talk to each other. So just write in at feedback@investorhour.com with questions, comments, and politely worded criticisms, I should remind you this week. And I'll tell you what I mean by that in a moment. And I read every single one of them, including the Russian spam. And I try to answer, you know, I answer as many as I can. And I'm going to do that starting right now with the first one by Jeff S. And Jeff S. asks a very good question, one that I've seen other people ask. And Jeff S. says, so everyone is raving about Joel Lipman, you, Doc, Porter, Jared, etc. I watched the video about High Alpha, and I understand it a little better after your interview. But my question is, if published quarterly gap results are just okay, but the stock goes up, then how is the demand grader based on that published data? His uniform accounting data is not public knowledge, so he can't say that this is resulting in the stock gains. Therefore, what good is it that I see his true accounting data when it can't possibly be responsible for the stock growth? Does that make sense? If not, then I'll see you next week and try to explain it in person. Well, Jeff, I'm going to try to explain it now because you make a very good point here, and I want to clarify what Jeff is really saying and what other folks have asked as well is, if Joel Lipman, who we had on the program last week, if he is publishing this special data just for the readers of High Alpha, how can that be responsible for the gains that investors will make if nobody else gets to see that data? And the point is this. The point is that ultimately the market finds out about the performance of a good business, even if it's misrepresented by the general accounting principles and by the, you know, the normal published financials that the whole world gets to read. And I don't even think, you know, Joel is saying that absolutely no one else in the market does this kind of work. Certainly very few people do it, and nobody offers it to a general audience like we do. So, or, you know, like Joel does through, you know, with Stansberry's help. So it's not that this true accounting data that Joel publishes in High Alpha ever hits the market. It does, because I think, and I believe Joel will tell you this, you know, cash is king, and the cash earnings of the business will eventually shine through. And in fact, I would suspect that, you know, these effects, the effect of the market not figuring out a business, it doesn't last forever. But Joel can just do it earlier than other people because he's got better tools. And I hope that makes sense, Jeff. It's an excellent question. And it looks like you're going to be in Las Vegas next week. So by all means, grab me in the hallway and say hello and tell me if my answer was good enough. Okay, the next one is by Ronan B. And Ronan B. says, good afternoon, Dan. I'm a fairly new listener and very much enjoy the podcast. I also appreciate your book recommendations on the podcast. I am currently reading A Demon of Our Own Design. While reading today, I came across a paragraph that caused me to sit back in my chair. And I will read this quote. It's kind of long, but it's really good. Quote, in the bucket shop era of the early 1900s, stock operators manipulated prices and churned positions to attract hungry investors who were looking to make a killing. In the internet era, The mechanism of a very narrow float was used to inflate stock prices and churn legitimate investors. In both cases, a high volume of trading was essential to move prices higher. In contrast, value-based market appreciation does not need much trading to elicit an increase in the market price. In fact, in the extreme case, envisioned by the effect of the market paradigm, new information that creates a shift in value will lead all investors to revalue their positions so that the price will change to a new equilibrium level without any trading. And he says that's on pages 177 and 178 of Demon of Our Own Design by Richard Buchstaber, or Buchstaber. I'm not sure how you say it. And then Ronan continues, this seems to happen time and again throughout history. Do you think this is what happened when the shift to value occurred last week? Best regards, Ronan B. So I've talked about the shift to value, and the Thursday edition of the Stansberry Digest, I also talked about it. And here's the thing. Yes, this happens time and time again throughout history. You certainly nailed that, and that was Buchstaber's point here, is that this always happens. Do you think this is what happened last week? Well, sort of. I think what he's talking about is just the difference between these bubble episodes where it seems like there's all this extra volume needed in the market to push the price higher than it really ought to go based on fundamentals. And then he's, the second half of it, he's saying, well, you know, when the fundamentals are all that's doing it, you don't need any, there's no big increase in volume needed. It's just people understand that it's worth more. And it just happens naturally without having some new, and I think Buchstaber might say artificial, influx of capital. You know, just there's no speculative rush of greed into the stock. That is the real point of that paragraph. The point of the shift to value occurring is, I believe, similar, because, but it's just kind of a change of the guard. So even if it looks like there's more volume in the trading, it's really just because folks who never expected to exit the momentum stocks are exiting, and folks who, you know, by the same token, folks who never expected to be buying cheap value, all of a sudden, oh, that's what they got to have. So I'm not sure if I really answered your question, but I think I did. So if I didn't, Ronan, maybe you could write back in and tell me what part I didn't fill in the blanks for on. So the next question is tough because it gets right at the heart of what we do at Stansberry Research and what our competitors do, though, too. And Fred C. writes in and he says, how does a small investor wade through the high number of newsletter promotions to find real gems? Well, we certainly like to crow about our products, and we're very proud of them, and we like to tell as many people as possible in the most enthusiastic way possible. And other people do this too. In fact, Stansberry is kind of so good at it that other people try to imitate our voice anyway. How does a small investor wade through all this? Man, it's tough. Part of it is, you know, you got to have a good BS detector. Like, what are they promising you? And what are they saying is the reason for why you should believe them and why they're right about, you know, if somebody says we're bullish on XYZ because of this reason, start there and try to tear it apart a little bit and ask yourself, you know, do I really think there's going to be, you know, a big war, let's say, and that all the defense stocks are going to take off like rocket ships? You know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Do I really think the price of gold is going to hit $2,500? Aaron, you know, John Doody, who is in partnership with Stansberry Research now, he pegged $2,500 in the fairly near term as a reasonable target for the price of gold. And if you look around, I mean, certainly, since he started saying that, the price of gold has done very well. So that's what I would say. Think about the promise that's being made and whether or not the reasons offered make sense to you. And I think once you've done that, you might be able to just sort of do away with a large number of the things that you're getting and that you're looking at. I hope that helps, Fred. I don't know if it does, but I really hope it does. If you have more questions on this, you know where to find us. Karen H. writes in a very short little note. Her email is titled, she titled her email, "No Trade Fees for TD Ameritrade Schwab." And then the text of her message is simply, "Hi, hopefully you will be commenting on this in the rant. Thanks." Well, we don't have a rant this week for reasons explained earlier in the program, but Karen H., thank you very much. You know, these people are, they're just highly competitive, these online brokers, and they're going to $0 commissions. And, you know, we'll see how it works out, and we'll see how long it lasts. I don't know how long we can expect it to last or how it'll work out. But certainly in the meantime, you know, you pay less for trades. Does that mean you should do more trading? Really, only you can answer that for sure. But I hope it doesn't mean that to you, because the more you churn and the more you churn, the worse it tends to work out for you. But it's a good question. Next and last is Steve J. And Steve J. writes in and says, "Hello, Dan. I love the podcast and think it is even better since you took it over." Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. He says, "I am a Charter Alliance member, joined at the IPO. Best investment I have made. It keeps paying dividends. I am trying to read all of your recommendations. I am, however, having trouble finding the correct chapters of Benjamin Graham's book. My book is the second edition. I thought you said chapters 8 and 20. In my book, 8 is specific standards for bond investments, and 20 is preferred stock protective provisions. Are these the correct ones? Thank you for your help." Steve, you're looking at the wrong book. You're looking at the second edition of Security Analysis by Benjamin Graham, and I want you to read chapters 8 and 20 of The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, okay? So get yourself a copy of The Intelligent Investor, read chapters 8 and 20, and you'll be doing the right thing. That's what I recommended. By all means, read Security Analysis. It's awesome. But Security Analysis, you know, you got to plow through the whole thing. It's a long slog, and there's a lot of stuff in there. But I do recommend you read that. So, good question. Glad we cleared that up. I'm glad everyone likes the book recommendations. One last thing I have to say is, lots of people wrote in about my comments about the 16-year-old girl, Greta Thunberg, who took a boat across the ocean and addressed the UN. And I said, she probably doesn't know what she's talking about. And people wrote in and they said, "Well, you know, I'm a scientist and I know what I'm talking about and you're an idiot." And there were some rude emails. That's why I don't want to read them. But they're all wrong. She doesn't know what she's talking about. And I'm not going to talk about this anymore. And so that's it. That's another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour podcast. Once again, it's my privilege to come to you as it is every week. Thank you so much for listening. I do appreciate your time. And look, no matter what, please keep writing in with comments, questions, and politely worded criticisms, please, to feedback@investorhour.com. And you can go to that same website and you can sign up. You can put your email in there and you can get all the updates from all the future podcasts that we're going to do. And you can find a recording and a transcript for every episode we've ever done, which is pretty cool. So do that, investorhour.com. Thank you so much. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email at feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is provided for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.